We're now, I want to look at chapter 1, verse 15 to 2, verse 7, that section, which has this amazing poem by Paul. And the commentators that I have read, three of them, suggest that it's Paul's writing rather than an inherited thing. And it's a beautiful piece of literature in its own way. And every time I read it, I just get slight goosebumps, I must admit. And I won't do it justice tonight. But what am I exploring in this section, chapter 1:15 to 2, verse 7? Christology, which is exploring who Jesus really is. It's a fancy word that we use as an all-embracing. Exploring who Jesus really is, that he is, his nature is God and man. But it also explores his role and his work. And that, therefore, rubs up again with this item of the gospel, and there'll be more in this section on what the gospel is. The other little things I want to touch on in this section is the word mystery that Paul uses several times in this letter, and fourthly, false teaching. So let's deal with the Christology at first. There isn't actually a break. We have a paragraph break in most versions of the Bible between verses 13 and verse 15 starts a new paragraph. But actually, the Christology stuff begins before that, the role that Jesus fulfills. So let's look at that verse 13. We've already read it. But he has rescued us from the power of darkness. This is what Christ does. So it's Christology. He's transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And I may be preempting, if I repeat myself, forgive me, but that always gets me excited. The people of Israel were delivered from Egypt before any instruction from God came in the Ten Commandments. God moves first to rescue us and then invites us to join in a covenant relationship and follow him in righteousness. So he's transferred us to the kingdom, the reign of his beloved Son. This is what God's done. And it's a kingdom, so he's a king, he's a ruler. Think of Isaiah chapter 9, which we love to read at Christmas. You know, he's a wonderful counselor, the everlasting father, and so on, this person who's coming. In whom we have redemption and the forgiveness of sins. The work of Jesus is to forgive sins. So when he forgives sins in the stories in the Gospels, he's saying, this is who I am. He's revealing that. And Paul's understood that. That's what Jesus does. This Messiah, for Paul, the word translated Christ, for him it's Messiah, the anointed one promised by the scriptures. And then 15 starts with this brilliant phrase, he is the image of the invisible God. In other words, Jesus fully represents the character and the nature of God as a human being. This is powerful words. And, theologians have attached the word incarnation, the embodying of God into this world. Now, it rings bells, doesn't it, with Genesis, where human beings, male and female, are made in the image of God. But this person, God, becomes the perfect man. He's not the fallen man who was originally created in the image of God, and we are in the image of God, but not redeemed until we come to Christ. But Jesus is the image of the invisible God, taking that Genesis theme, and he is a perfect human being, as he wants us to be, so that we can be with him in the garden. That's the whole idea, that we can have fellowship with God. God remains God, but we as human beings are made in his image. And Jesus comes as the image of God into our world to open up all these things that the gospel unpacks for us. So with that link, Jesus as a man fully represents God. That's what we understand. And John's gospel understands that, doesn't it? No one has ever seen God. The only Son, he has made him known. Or Philip's question to Jesus, show us the Father. And Jesus' reply, he who has seen me has seen the Father. There's often a criticism of Paul's writings. He doesn't seem to know the Gospels. Well, I think incipient in these phrases, he's the image of the invisible God. He's recognizing the life-transforming presence of Jesus of Nazareth very clearly. Verse 15 goes on that he's the firstborn of all creation. And creation is through him and it's for him. In other words, God did it for his own pleasure. And we're included in that. We're creatures of his pleasure. And what comes across in these verses in the chapter one here, this wonderful poem, is absolutely everything is under his ultimate control. And he's pre-existent. Before the worlds were formed, there was this person, Jesus, the Messiah. He's pre-existent. But Paul keeps using firstborn, and he knows why he's doing it. It's his way of saying, just a minute, in the Old Testament, Exodus 4:22, Israel is my firstborn son. And so Jesus represents the whole of Israel by being the firstborn. My beloved, as the Psalms call it. And as Jesus' baptism, God says, you're my beloved, one whom I love. Israel is my firstborn son. And in the Old Testament, it's the firstborn of Egypt who die. Jesus is the firstborn son of Mary. And Paul repeats here that Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. So he's before all things, and all things hold together in him. And what's amazing about Paul can talk about the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, the Trinity, as we've now called it. Actually, there's only one mention of the Spirit, and it's in chapter one in Colossians. But don't worry, Paul's not covering all theological matters. He's not dealing with the Trinity here. He's dealing with who Jesus is. Here we've got this firstborn idea that Jesus is the promised person of the Old Testament who's come to open up that kingdom for us. And it's nonetheless a monotheistic view of God. If he's the image of God, then he's inseparable from God. And it's a monotheistic thing, which Paul never abandons. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is the only Lord. And he's unique. There's only one of him. And so before him, all things hold together. Jesus is Lord. He puts that elsewhere in another letter. But good theology leads to good practice. And if Jesus is Lord, then we can be full of hope in a world that's broken and struggling. I often reflect on the parable of Jesus in Mark chapter 12, and it's repeated in Luke, I think, about the tenants who are wicked in the vineyard. And it reads like this, the parable of Jesus. Those tenants said to one another, this is the heir, come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. They've killed previous messengers, the prophets, they've abused other people, and they're in power, they're in charge. So they seized him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. The inheritance will be ours. This vineyard will be ours. Now, if you've heard of every envoy being killed, you'd think that if the owner of the vineyard turns up, he'll get killed. Because these are powerful tenants. But verse 9 of Mark 12 says, well, then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. This passage here, when you read it in Colossians, Jesus is preeminent. First Corinthians 15, because he's the firstborn from the dead, which is mentioned here. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul Paul writes, for he must reign until he's put all enemies under his feet. This is the purpose of God that Paul understands as to who Christ is. Chapter 1, verse 18, he's the head of the church, head of the body, the church. I find it interesting that Tom Wright, in his commentary on Colossians and Philemon, it's quite an old one, but he's as erudite as ever, points out here that Paul has been talking about Jesus as the creator, and now he's addressing the new creation, the church. And I think that's a very helpful transition in this poem of Paul's. He's the head of the body, the church. And so he's been the creator of the universe, and he's preeminent in that. And now he must be preeminent in the church too, because the new creation is evolving. Chapter 1, verse 19. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Wow. This always makes me have goosebumps. All the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Well, the commentaries point out that the word God doesn't occur in this particular phrase. It's assumed by, and it's a good job it's put in because it's an assumption that's correct. But in chapter 2, verse 9, if you pop over to there, chapter 2, verse 9, there's a repeat, but clearly with God in mind. For in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. This poem continues with that clear emphasis that God is here as a man amongst us. God was pleased, it says, for all his fullness to be in Jesus. When you read Genesis chapter 1 and the creation, God is pleased with his work. And here's God pleased with what he's doing. Let's enjoy the fact that God's enjoying redeeming the world. And he's gone to great lengths to do it. Because God is reconciling mankind to himself through Jesus alone. But notice also in 2 verse 9, the fullness of God is a noun, but in verse 10 it says, you have come to fullness in him. And though it's a verb, it's got the same root as fullness in the original language. I'm not an expert in Greek, but I can see the two words are similar, pleroma, and the verb fullness in him. In other words, Paul is saying in this poem, God's fullness comes into us too, when we turn to Christ. Which brings me on to my second point, that the gospel is in this wonderful poem as well. So 1 verse 20, I've already mentioned it. Through him, God was pleased to reconcile himself. To reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace through the blood of his cross. The gospel at work in people's lives because God is doing the reconciling work. And this is why Jesus is this preeminent character in Paul's letter. So like the rescue from Egypt of the people of Israel, God acts and rescues them. And if we're willing to turn to him, he will rescue us. The gospel in all its power. Verse 21 and 22 of chapter 1 adds to the gospel. Verse 22, he has now reconciled in his fleshly body through death. Here's the gospel again. The death of Christ is utterly central for Paul. So as to present you holy, i.e. set apart, and blameless and irreproachable before him. It's extraordinarily powerful, this hymn about Jesus Christ that he writes. But the gospel also continues a warning, doesn't it? Verse 23, provided that you continue securely established and steadfast in the faith. Let me touch now on the word mystery that occurs in verse 26 as an example. Mystery is very simple to define in Paul's writing. It just means something that had to be revealed by God that could not have been understood through philosophy or conjecture or working it all out yourself. So it's something that's revealed. So it's not a mystery at all. It's something that's been hidden and now revealed. And that's what Paul is saying, that the mystery, verse 26, that has been hidden through the ages and generations, but now has been revealed to his saints. And what is that mystery? Verse 27, to them God chose to make known how great among the Gentiles are the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Paul is utterly clear that God issued a plan, a master plan, way back to Abraham. Abraham, I've called you. He calls Abraham before telling him instructions how to live a godly life. He calls Abraham and says, come follow me, like he did, Jesus did for the disciples. Abraham is called to follow God and go to a new land. And God repeatedly says, and it's repeated so often that you've got to get it clear, through you, through your descendants, Abraham, all the nations, i.e. Gentiles of the earth, will find blessing. And for Paul, this mystery that was hidden away is now revealed. It's broken out and includes the Gentiles. And that's what the mystery is. It's come to light now that everybody's included. Very exciting.
It is very exciting, Peter. While the Zoom room is thinking of further questions, comments, or even perhaps prayer, I want to pick up a question from Kathy Hall. Kathy, thank you for asking this question. When was the book written? Interesting, Peter, you didn't kind of go into the background details. What have you picked up in your study recently around the background of Colossae? We know a Colossian heresy, but a little bit about kind of the background of the letter, please.
Okay, well, it's clearly before AD 70, which is the cataclysmic moment when the temple's destroyed. So it's early. I do know that Thessalonians is the earliest writing of Paul, written before the Gospels. And Paul's in prison. It's not his final one, because that's expressed in Timothy. So it would suggest that this was written before the letter to Timothy, the second letter to Timothy, where Paul is clearly about to be executed. And so round about late 50s, early 60s AD is suggested. I always find, it can be helpful, but I've missed it out because you can read it up and it's conjecture ultimately worked out. But there are the clues.
Right. Michael, Glenn, David, Graham, Chris, Vicky, have you got any questions for Peter? Yeah, go on, Graham.
Peter, you said that Paul doesn't deal with the Trinity here. Does he actually deal with it anywhere else specifically? Do you know? Trinity is thought of as something that's kind of put together almost by inference.
Yeah. As you know, Trinity is something that became around about 300, 400 AD a major issue for the church. And the word Trinity was a useful and it's a very helpful phrase to explain how we are monotheistic and yet believe there are three persons in the Godhead. The clue about Paul is it's just inherent there in the way he writes. He'll write about the Spirit or the Spirit of God or even the Spirit of Jesus. And in this passage, we see clearly he's seeing Jesus as God. So it's inferred from what he writes. It's so natural to him. But because Paul is clearly a monotheist, as we are, a believer in one and only one God, he doesn't try to explain it. He just expresses the fact that God reveals him this in this way. And I'm deeply comfortable with that, because it's funny, isn't it, how the memory fails when you get older. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all. There's an example of Paul just creating a Trinitarian statement without explaining it.
David.
I had been going to ask you about this, but you've already mentioned it. Jehovah's Witnesses love this "he is the firstborn of all creation" verse, because they like to use it as a trick to try to get you to say that Jesus must have been created, otherwise he wouldn't be the firstborn. But I now understand what you were doing with this, which was firstborn is understood in the themes that Paul is exploring. Israel is my firstborn son, and so on. The only question I have about that is, when I do Bible stream, I'm always encouraging people, you've got to keep things in context. You can't just take out one verse and make it say whatever you want it to say. So usually when I say that to a Jehovah's Witness, they'll say, oh, but you just told me I had to take the Bible in context. Now you're just pulling out a theme. How do we get this balance right?
Oh, it's very hard to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, isn't it? Because they are told how to interpret each verse. And in their courses, there's always a footnote. This verse means this, and you can't deviate from it. And you're a very good, you think on your feet, David, and I'm always impressed by that. I find it much harder to do. I would never be in a law court because I wouldn't see the issues quickly enough. But the firstborn, Paul is picking up his Old Testament themes, as you've pointed out, and as I've tried to point out. And that's therefore important for us to do the same. What is Paul's source for his theology? And ultimately it is the Old Testament. It's a modified Judaism, but it's still Judaism. We don't need to become Jews. Let's not worry about that. Gentiles can remain Gentiles, and Jewish people by race can remain Jewish. But the point is, Paul is saying the gospel now is to all people, and God's plan was always that. And so he's using those Old Testament themes, and that's where we've got to spread our wings. And one of the encouraging things I find now in more modern commentaries is the whole Bible is looked at when interpreting texts, say in the New Testament, rather than just analyzing the Greek text. One thing that I find useful is sometimes to look into the Greek Old Testament to see what that word is. For example, there are two words for the congregation in the Old Testament, but one of them is ecclesia. So when I see the word church in the New Testament, I realize that it was used before for the congregation. So the church didn't suddenly happen in the New Testament. God's church was already there. Anyway, that's a little aside.
Peter, thank you very much indeed. So we've covered two parts, and I presume you're taking us to what Paul often does, which is to doctrine and practice. And you used a very good expression earlier. Good theology leads to good practice. So, yeah.